Welcome to From the Sidelines with Northumberland FA. Thanks again for giving up your time to discuss some key themes around your career, coaching pathways and role models that have influenced you. Sarah is a Geordie at heart, having previously played for Newcastle United Women before progressing into coaching, where she holds a UEFA Pro Licence qualification. Sarah is the current assistant coach at National Women's Soccer League club Portland Thorns and has had a vast coaching career working at first team level after recently moving to Portland from NWSL rivals Houston Dash. Sarah, welcome.
Lloyd, thanks for having us. I really appreciate it.
Great stuff. Sarah, so tell us about your career so far.
Well, I'll go back to the very beginning. So when I was 16, I got my first coaching badge at Gateshead College, and it was the FA Level 1. And you know, I always knew that I wanted to coach from a very, very young age. I was a massive fan of Bobby Robson when I was growing up. That was the manager, I guess, most influential manager probably in my career as I was growing up at Newcastle. And so always knew I was kind of obsessed with the player management side of the game. And from there, ended up going to America at 18. I had that planned out from the age of 15. And I started in Mississippi. And then I went to Louisiana. So talk about going from Newcastle to the deep south of America. Massive, massive culture shock. And it's funny because on the plane ride from Atlanta to Starkville, which is Starkville, Mississippi, because I attended the Mississippi State University to begin, there was a circus on the plane and just me in the circus. So I feel like that kind of set us up for the entire duration that I've been in America. But no, started in Louisiana, Mississippi, like I said, and then moved to Texas for my first ever coaching opportunity. And like I said, I always knew I wanted to coach. So I started a small school called Wayland Baptist University in Plainview, Texas. And let us tell you, Plainview lived up to its name because there was absolutely nothing there. And I spent 10 months there. And then from there, I just knew that I wanted to kind of work at a higher level. It was my first coaching role. I really had no idea what I was doing. I was the same age as the players. You know how that goes. You get to a point where you're trying to separate from, I was a volunteer coach at the place that I had also played at. So you're trying to separate from player to coach. Then I ended up working with the Houston Dash actually as a volunteer. Had no business being there at the time. The US national team had just won the World Cup and Carly Lloyd, Megan Klingenberg, and Morgan Bryan were on that team for Houston. So it was like just a really unique opportunity to be around that at the time. And like I said, like I had no business being there, but I was very good at picking up cones and carrying equipment and anything that they needed and kind of doing a little bit of stats work at the time. And then from there, I ended up getting a job. The goalkeeping coach for the Dash was the head coach at Sam Houston State University. And I got a job with him as an assistant coach. They were looking for someone with an exercise science background. And I had been to school and got that degree. And then from there, ended up, you know, again, getting to a point where this is where my career really started to shape. And I'm sure we'll talk about this later, Lloyd. But I wanted to basically work with someone where my core values aligned. And kind of as I started to specialize and kind of being the coach that I wanted to be, I ended up moving to the University of Florida as an equipment manager. And people always kind of joke, like, why were you an equipment manager? But it was a way to get in at that level. At the University of Florida, it's a Power 5 school, top 5 public school in the country. So I got my foot in there. And then after 4 years, I went to Penn State University and then jumped into the pro game, which was unexpected. So then I was the assistant coach at Houston for 6 weeks. Due to unforeseen circumstances, ended up becoming the head coach at Houston, acting head coach, if you like. Talk about drinking out of a fire hose, because I'd never, ever been a head coach before. And then you're kind of a head coach in the best league in the world and trying to stay afloat. And then from there, obviously went back to being assistant and then took over at the end of this last year as well. So got some really valuable experience in Houston. And then now I'm in Portland as an assistant coach.
Fantastic. So a good wealth of experience, certainly at college level before progressing into the program, which I'm sure, you know, that vast amount of experience at college level certainly better equipped you for where you are now. So we'll definitely come back to kind of coaching opportunities and coaching pathways as well as we'll get through the podcast. But the next question I had was around who have inspired you and why.
It's a great question. You know, I was thinking about this, like, in terms of inspired, admired. I would say very early in my career, it would have been like Alan Shearer. And I used to pretend, I'm sure we all did, used to pretend of being Alan Shearer in the streets, playing street football.
Some of us still do, eh?
Well, I wish I could still play at that level, but I think I would probably pull a hamstring. But yeah, so it was kind of Shearer when I was growing up. And then, you know, when I started to really research the States when I was probably 14, 15, because like I said, I knew I was going to try and go over at the age of 15. I started to really see the women's national team, the US women's national team, with Abby Wambach, Julie Foudy, Kristen Lilly, Carla Overbeck, Carly Lloyd. So those players, I guess, were the, it was the first time I really had, I guess, female role models to look up to. Obviously not British by any stretch. And then we also had, obviously, Arsenal women at the time were kind of the team in England. So Katie Chapman, Faye White, those types of players were definitely. But I just don't think there was that much access to watching them play. I don't remember. I didn't have access to get to London. And so, yeah, so I would say also any other female coach that I had Melanie Ray, Gates at college, my PE teacher at school, were definitely like these female role models that I definitely admired and looked up to for sure.
Brilliant, brilliant. I think they make a good point. Certainly now it's maybe changed only for the better around the amount of women's matches now televised. Certainly going down, it was, you know, from tier three up, there's some way that, you know, people can watch games, whether it be on a YouTube stream, but or certainly on Sky, etc. So that's great stuff. So obviously there's you made reference to these particular women players, certainly over in the States, and some of the Arsenal players. Was there maybe one or two that stood out a little bit more than others? You know, whether it be their demeanour or, yeah, anything like that?
That's a great question. I think I had an England shirt with Katie Chapman's name on the back. I think I liked her tenacity and the way she played. Again, didn't get to see a lot of actual games, but I did used to get on YouTube. You know how you get on YouTube and like just watch videos? And I'm sure these videos were like all pixelated because of the quality. The quality back then wasn't as good, but I think I really enjoyed watching her play. And I did actually get with Newcastle, we went down and watched some of the Euro games as well, which was cool. So I remember watching Sweden play. And then I would say Abby Wambach was a big key figure. And I was very fortunate because she went to the University of Florida, and obviously I ended up working there. And that was part of the quest to work at the University of Florida. So I've been able to obviously briefly have some interactions with her, but just watching her play and kind of, I remember a goal against Brazil in the World Cup when Rapinoe sends that ball in. So just those key moments, I would say, but those two kind of stand out.
Brill. Yeah, so I guess, you know, moving on to the next kind of question, which ties in nicely to your last point. Can you tell us some of the key moments that have motivated you and inspired you within your career? That could be as a player, but certainly as a coach?
I think probably more as a coach. I think one of the reasons why I really wanted to become a coach was just kind of the leadership side of the game and the ability to connect and influence people. And I would say my intentional move to the University of Florida as an equipment manager, I mean, I did everything the equipment manager did for sure, but I was able to spend 4 years in the head coach's office, right? I had kind of my own little desk and a chair, and I wrote this little, I don't really want to call it a book, but a kind of a little a testimonial to the head coach, because she ended up retiring and her name is Becky Burley. And just what she was able to do in her 27 years of coaching, the way she was able to adapt, because you can imagine 27 years, like the realm changes within 2-3 years, let alone 27. So I really admired her ability to adapt to the generation that she was coaching, especially as she got older, which is obviously when I was there. And so those 4 years, I would say, shaped me not just as a coach, but as a person for sure. And it was the best 4 years of my career, hands down. And I just think I was able to evolve and figure out, you know, like just values, who I was, what I stood for, how to inspire people, how to motivate people. And again, I didn't really have the title as an assistant coach, right? But I got the experience. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that I'm sure we'll touch on later. But I was able to basically get a grounding for my career to build upon. And I think that's the foundation. And Penn State also helped after that. And it just gave me a completely different insight. Penn State was, I was there for 8-9 months, but it also shaped kind of my thoughts on game model, identity, that sort of thing. Because Florida was a very different style of play. It was very positional play, very, you know, kind of Man City-ish, I suppose, in a simple way to put it. And then Penn State was a little bit more, can you hurt teams in transition? And so I think just kind of getting those two different experiences was massive in my career. But definitely from the human side at Florida was definitely the grounding of my career. And I will always stand by that.
Well, so just on that one. So obviously you're immersed in that coach's office with Becky, and obviously over time she clearly got an insight into some of your added motivations for being within the soccer program. So how did you maybe persuade her, or was it actually she approached you with maybe the opportunity to get involved in some way on the grass?
That's a good question. You know, what's funny is when I first emailed Becky for an opportunity, she completely ignored my email, which, to be fair, like, when you're a head coach, especially at that level, like Power 5, Pro, every head coach is busy for sure. And like, I had no idea what a head coach did. And I, like, until you actually sit in that seat, like, you have no idea. You think you do. I spent 4 years in her office and thought I knew what a head coach did at that level. But the reality is you don't, because it's 24/7 coaching. There's the rub. There's always something to do, right? And so, yeah, I think I emailed her, didn't answer. And so what I ended up doing was there was a coaches convention that I knew she was going to be at. And it was a small convention where it was kind of, it was kind of a cohort. So it was only going to be 30 people in it. And I applied for this because I knew Becky was going to be a speaker. And so I think I paid $2,700. So it's like college tuition. And I went to this like 5-day event in Denver, Colorado, and she was there. And I remember like, first of all, like I had these heels on because we had to dress up and I can't walk in heels. So I like already felt like so uncomfortable. and I remember like walking through the hallway, like trying to like make eye contact with her. And I was just like so nervous, and it's kind of laughable. But anyway, at night at the social, I basically just said, can I buy you a drink? And I just said, look, like, how can I work for you? And that's how it started. So I basically got myself in front of her. I said, I'd emailed a couple of times. She did actually respond to me second or third email, just like kind of giving us some advice as a female coach, young coach as well. And I think that's important to mention. But yeah, then eventually we like figured out a way to get me there. Like at first it was like looking at like trying to get in as a janitor or like a cafeteria worker, because I was willing to do anything like to get there.
And if anyone's wondering, I'm guessing that's just a cleaner, isn't it?
honestly, like, it was just, how can I get there and learn from her? And it's not just her, but her staff. And I think one thing in Florida that's really unique is like everyone in Florida is winning national championships. So the pressure to win there internally is like massive, because you see volleyball winning a national championship, you see track winning a national championship, and soccer hasn't won one in what, like 15 years. So like there's this pressure internally, not just to perform from a result standpoint in the league, but also like internally. So to be able to learn from like a bunch of other coaches in different sports, I don't even think the amount of resources that Florida had, I probably didn't even scratch the surface of what I could have. But yeah, that was kind of the story on that, is I basically hounded it until I got an opportunity. And then it took about 8 months for it all to come to fruition. I didn't get there till the summer of 2017.
And so, when you joined up with Becky, what was your first role? Was it kit and equipment manager?
Yeah, it was an equipment manager to begin. Okay. And then I moved into the director of ops role. I wouldn't say this is unfortunate, because I definitely had the experience there for sure. But now there's a third assistant that's been added to NCAA D1 programs. And so I definitely probably would have had that opportunity now to move into a coaching role there. If the timing was a little bit different, but I definitely worked myself into a position where if there was a position open, which there wasn't, but if there was, I definitely would have been able to get into that, because those were the conversations that we had. And I think at the very beginning, Becky was like, when you come here, like, there is no coaching role for you. Like, it was very black and white. Like, don't come here with expectations that you'll move into a coaching role. But I got to a point where I had just worked myself into a position where, like, they didn't want to lose me. And so they were trying to create a position for me, and then Becky ended up retiring. But I think that's what's really unique, is I had no expectations, but I was like, I'm just going to come in here and give it everything and see what happens.
Yeah, I think there's a, you know, as we were chatting, like a few things that really did stand out. I think, you know, that saying of it's not what you know, but who you know, I think it works vice versa, that, you know, you don't get to know who you know unless you know something, you know, you've got some knowledge base that you can really lean on, because I guess that's sometimes you go to when you're using interpersonal skills, like, you know, when you're trying to catch her out a drink, when you've probably been listening to her and others at the convention. And I guess you only get one first impression, so it obviously works.
In those heels.
Yeah. Yeah, so, no, brilliant. Yeah, so I guess obviously, you know, you've clearly thrown yourself at multiple coaching opportunities and only learned as time went on. So why should, you know, those females involved in grassroots football in some capacity, whether it be simply as a parent or guardian, with a possible interest of coaching, give it a go?
Well, I think the bottom line is we need more female representation in our female sport. I think that's the first thing I would say. And I think the ability to... Coaching is all about influence. And I think we've kind of gone from the days where, like, coaches that coach through power are kind of slowly being, I don't know what the right word is. Yeah, phased out for sure, because of the generation that we're coaching. So it's all about influence. And I think, you know, when I grew up, like, you know, the question that you ask about who were your female role models, like, I mean, I named obviously ones that were, that I had been able to watch on YouTube or was able to read about. But the reality is like, now grown up, these young girls can actually have, if I can see it, I can be it, and they can turn on the TV and watch Ella Toon or, you know, Mary Earps, whatever. And I think back then, like, we just didn't have that, you know, kind of ability. But I also think as well, like, having a female coach, like, I was very fortunate I had a female coach before I left for the States. But after that, like, I didn't play for a female coach. And so I think if you can see it, you can be it as well. Like, that's really, mm-hmm. really important. But I think, again, I think the big word I'd use is just the ability to have the influence. And I think that's what coaching is all about. It's about influencing people. It's using the sport as a platform. And it's the, kind of the vehicle, if you like, for life lessons. And I think that's one of the big things that I've learned is we use this sport as the ability to impact people for the future, not just in the present.
Brilliant. Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Sarah. So, you know, when you got your first break coaching, say, in the States, what were, like, some of the, I guess, feelings going into the role, and how did them change? How did those particular feelings or, yeah, interactions with others change over the, like, first few months?
That's a good question as well. I think I will say this, like, I definitely had and still have imposter syndrome for sure. And I think probably I would actually say that I know a lot of other female coaches just from seminars and symposiums, if you like, that I've been to, where we've done activities where you have to put things on the wall that's your biggest fear. And, like, a lot of them on the wall are, like, imposter syndrome. Like, a lot of females suffer with that, I think. And I think it's just because of the lack of opportunity that females have probably had, so they don't have the experience, if you like. But I definitely am somebody that suffered with that and still suffers with that to some degree. And I think that's probably been something that has hindered me for sure, but it's also probably a big strength, because maybe I don't realize that I am actually good enough, but that's what makes me work harder and be better in the craft, if you know what I mean, rather than being too overconfident. And but yeah, I would say that's the biggest probably challenge, is just the imposter syndrome part of, you know, being surrounded in a very male dominated environment, let's face it, especially in the pro game. Yeah. Like, your entire technical staff is male. I'm the only female, and I think sometimes always question, like, am I good enough? Which, no, I am, otherwise I wouldn't be here. But the reality is those are the barriers that I think maybe a lot of women face. But again, I think it's not just my biggest weakness, it's also a biggest strength in a way, for sure.
Yeah, I think I can personally relate, and I'm sure female and male coaches that listen to this podcast will probably breathe a sigh of relief that sometimes listening to a podcast like this and hearing that, you know, others at the highest level of the game also have imposter syndrome, where they doubt their credibility or what they can bring in terms of their roles and skills. I think, yeah, we'll certainly make people think twice that it's only them. So kind of just on that one, because honestly, I think imposter syndrome is something that maybe doesn't get chatted about enough. Was there maybe one or two things you did personally to make sure that you just continued your craft?
Well, I'm an over-preparer and an over-planner. So no matter how prepared and over, like how much planning I've done, I still would like, you know, like even if I had delivered a session, like I'm still very self-critical. Like I just always have been that way. But I also think that's the constant reflection is what also helps improvement. But I would just say the more success that I've had throughout my career has kind of justified like, okay, like, I mean, like I said, I went through the parole course last year, which was the best course I've ever done in my career for sure. And the best experience that I had. And even I remember starting that course being like, I do not belong here. And then, you know, when you get to the end of the course, like just the compliments that, you know, again, like the instructor was like, you are the best candidate I've ever had on the course. And to hear that from someone that's like a pro licensed instructor, you know, and I think that's, it's not about being the best coach. Honestly, it's really not, because my experience in that room was very, very limited compared to everybody else's. But I just think it's the amount of effort and dedication and ability to be curious and stay curious. But I would just say the more that you get that sort of feedback, and the more you have a little bit of success, just kind of shows you that, you know, you do belong. But I would say, I don't know if it's something that you can ever fully overcome, to be honest. I think our sport is filled with fear and doubt. That's the reality of it.
Yeah. No, great. So we've got, you know, quite a thriving female-only coaches program that supplements our coach-to-coach program called the Lionesses Coach Development Program. But within our county at Northumberland, there's plenty of female coaches out there who still thrive in some coaching capacity with a grassroots football. Some female coaches can think twice about applying for their next coaching qualification. That can result in them not applying at all. You mentioned you've received, you know, the highest coaching qualification recognised globally within football, the UEFA Pro Licence. What advice would you offer female coaches, as well as male coaches listening, who are thinking twice about applying for that next coaching qual?
Well, I would highly encourage people to definitely apply for coaching credentials, licences, diplomas, whatever it is, because I think it's the constant quest for learning, right? And I think, like in this sport, we're never done. And the day we think we're done is the day we probably shouldn't be in the sport. So I think the biggest thing and the biggest message I would say is like the coaching courses that I've done, I've definitely had anxieties about, for example, on B license, C license, A license. As you get higher, you kind of have more doubts and more anxiety perhaps. But I would just say like the coaching courses I've been on, like that's been at the very beginning of the course. But once you get on it, the people that you meet, like the coaching courses are great, but it's the people that you meet in the network that you build. And that's what sport, that's what our sport is all about. I don't think we do a good enough job as coaches at networking. Like we network because we need something. We don't network because it's a way of life, if that makes sense. And I think coaching courses give us the opportunity to do that, is to network with people from all different walks of life and experiences. My experience, Lloyd, like you grew up in Newcastle, I grew up in Newcastle until I was 18, and obviously you spent some time in the States, but our experiences are so different. And that's from the same city. And so you can go to the same high school and have completely different experiences based on who's in your class, who your teachers are. So everybody can offer something based on what they've experienced. And I think that's so important. But I would just encourage, like, it's the constant quest, like we're never done and we're always kind of chasing this yet. And like, we never actually reach the yet. And I think that's like what's so important is it's like, you know, you get a coaching qualifications and you're done. But the reality is like I have the pro license, but like the learning is far from over. If anything, it's just starting. So I would encourage people to do it from the networking standpoint, from the curiosity of learning. And yeah, I think everybody has something to offer and we can all learn from each other.
Real. And I think the way the course are shaped, you know, there's a lot of discussions deliberately timetabled in, especially the C license here with the FA, which was probably previously known as the level two. You know, locally we see like that probably being the biggest qual that's in demand because there's so many level ones or introduction to coaching qualification level coaches. So yeah, I think it's great that you made that point around it's a network and don't do it because you have to, but do it because it's part of that learning experience. because like you say, there's no two coaches with this identical experiences. Rule. Yeah, you mentioned it earlier around representation, and if, certainly if you can see it, you can be it. Was there anything you wanted to add to that, or any extra bits that you wanted to discuss?
Yeah, again, I think women haven't like historically had opportunities. And so I would say, like, for me or like for another female, like, we don't have the opportunities to move into the men's game. We can argue that there's some limited opportunities. We can say that there's Lydia Bedford that's coaching at Brentford, for example. But I can't really think of, there's a few others maybe out there that are coaching in the men's game. And you hear about these stories and they pop up because they're rare. Women don't have that opportunity, whereas males have the opportunity to pick the women's or the men's game. So there's like a multitude of other opportunities out there. And like I said, historically, women haven't had the opportunities that maybe their male counterparts have had in the past. So the reality is when we hire potentially a female candidate, they may not have the experience on paper that a male counterpart would have, right? It's just the reality of it. And so at some point, we have to give opportunities in order to have female representation in the female game. And so I think that's super, super important. And like we mentioned earlier, like, if we want females to grow up wanting to be coaches, like if you want female players to grow up and want to be coaches, then we have to have females in leadership roles, because the reality is like, we have to have that representation in terms of what people can look up to and aspire to be. And it's funny, like, if you look at the college athletic directors in the US, a lot of them are male. There's very few females. I can think of one female AD. I think she's at the University of Pittsburgh. And there's a couple of others out there. But, like, we have to have more women wanting to grow up to be athletic directors, because the reality is, like, we don't have female in those leadership positions to then hire females. Does that make sense?
So, it does, yeah.
Yeah. So I think there definitely has to be opportunities. And we're definitely seeing that in this country, in the US, where females are getting the opportunity. And I think it's important for sure in our game.
Great. Yes, that probably leads us nicely on to what are some of the challenges that you've experienced within your coaching?
Challenges that I've experienced within coaching. That's a great question. The first one that I really think about is work-life balance. Maybe it's work-life integration. That's the first challenge, I would say. I've never really found that balance, or maybe there isn't balance. Maybe that's the whole point. Maybe it is just the work-life integration part. I would say that's been a massive challenge, especially in the pro game, because it's an 11-month season. And so, you know, typically a day off is after a game, but you've got to get the game review turned around. You've got to get the scouting done for the next game. And so I think, again, being an over planner and preparer can also hinder you, because sometimes you just don't have that time in coaching. And you see it where, you know, I don't have kids, but coaches that have kids probably, sometimes I think, how do they do it? But then I also think, like, they have to manage their time more efficiently than I would, because I have the time to maybe spend a couple more hours on something that maybe they don't have, because they have to devote some time to their kids, and rightly so. So I think that's the first challenge that I've definitely faced and I'm still working on. And then other challenges that I've experienced, that's a good one. I would say that's the only one that pops up. I mean, there's definitely been other challenges. I think, again, the imposter syndrome one pops up, like, just the ability to know that you're good enough to be there. I think, like you said, like, there's a lot of people that probably suffer with that, whether they admit it or not. But I would say those are the two biggest ones that probably spring to mind right now, for sure.
Just out of interest, how's that schedule and workload differed between your roles at college level to the pro game in the US?
Well, the college season runs from August to November, and it's pretty condensed. So you have two games a week. So it is pretty intense when you're in it. And then in the spring, you only have 5 game dates. But it's definitely like a different grind, like, for coaches, because you're recruiting the entire year. Whereas in the pro game, like, you have a recruiting and scouting department, and yes, you're involved in that, but it's not as, like, you're not flying all over the country trying to find talent. So the grind is just different. I think in the NWSL and the MLS, like, we play all over the country. So you go east to west coast, central of the U.S., you go to the central part of the U.S. And so, you know, Portland, traveling to New York, and then coming back, and then traveling to D.C., and then traveling to Orlando, traveling to Houston, traveling to California. you can see just how that every other week is, it's a lot, right? You're on a 4-hour flight for the majority of, well, half of the league for sure. So yeah, I would say those are definitely challenges, but every team has the same sort of, every team has similar challenges. Maybe they're a little bit different when you pull back the curtain, but every team definitely has their challenges for sure.
Yeah. I was going to say, maybe it's another challenge you've had, like the jet lag with all that air time.
Exactly. Yeah, you get used to it. You just do a lot of work on those planes just to kill the dead time.
No, definitely. So we're just nearing towards the end of the podcast. Brilliant listening. Some real key takeaways, I think, for coaches that are listening around challenges, experiences, what the benefit can be for just sticking at something, whether it be a coaching qualification or trying to unearth an opportunity that might not be simply there straight away. What's one of the single biggest things that you've maybe learned in your coaching?
Oof, I would say the biggest thing I've learned in coaching is a lot of people try and climb the ladder as fast as possible to get to where they want to go. And I think the most important thing I've learned is, and especially from that Houston experience that I mentioned earlier, like being in the assistant position for 4 to 6 weeks and then all of a sudden becoming the head coach and never been a head coach before, I would say like being prepared as possible is more important than climbing the ladder as fast as possible. Because the reality is yes, you need references to help you get in the door, but you also need people to support you when you do have the job so you can succeed. And I think that's been so important. And when everything happened in Houston, Becky was the first person I called. And I think Emmett Hayes said this really well, but like you have to have different mentors and thinking partners that you tap into at different times, right? Like if I have a management question, I'm definitely going to call Becky. If I have a tactical question, like there's definitely somebody else. And not because Becky can't answer the tactical question, but like there's somebody I would call for the tactical question. If I have a question on cap or roster management, like that's going to be somebody else. And so I think like having those mentors that you can tap into at different times, like Becky was the first person I hired at Houston as a consultant, like just to help us be successful in the job. And she not only helped me get the job at Houston in the first place, but also helped me maintain the job over the 2 years. So I think that's so, so important. It's not about climbing the ladder as fast as you can. It's about being prepared as possible when you get there.
Mm-hmm. I think you made a good point around the mentor bit, and it might even be like a more of a coaching buddy, because I think working at grassroots football, I think there's more and more teams now that have two coaches or more rather than everyone doing it on their own. So I think those listening, you know, I think one big thing to take away from that is tap into each other, but also maybe open up to maybe other coaches that you feel that are like-minded. Just trying to draw some relation to what I'll look like over here. But definitely, I think that's some really powerful points. On the ladder bit, yeah, I think there's been times where everyone's probably guilty of maybe wanting to go to the next qualification. But I think learning the qual continues beyond passing it. So I think, yeah, is there anything that you'd want to share around, you know, the qualification, but also getting extra bolt-ons to just turning up and completing the course dates?
Yeah, again, I think it's, you know, everybody's got a kind of, I guess, in the US anyway, like over my experience, like sometimes you have to adapt the way that you coach to get the piece of paper, right? You have to kind of fit what they're asking. Mm-hmm. But I would say, like, again, it goes back to that networking piece for me. It's about find the experience that's in the room. Like, you want to be in a room where you're not the smartest in there. And the reality is like, you always want to put yourself in a room where, you know, maybe you have the least experience. And I think that was one of the really cool parts about the pro courses. Like, I kind of felt like the person that was, like, the least smartest, if that makes sense. And I think that's like really powerful because you have so much experience in the room. We have US national team coaches, we have MLS coaches, we have USL coaches. But the reality is like you also have, and I also had a bunch of experiences that I had that people didn't have, right? Like in terms of finding and searching for leaders and coaches that I wanted to work for. I was very lucky at Penn State where I was able to work for Erica Dambach, who was very also close with the national team. She would work with the US at the Olympics and the World Cups. And so I think like just being able to surround yourself with people that have different experiences is what's really powerful, and kind of picking other people's brains, if you like. And I know that's kind of a cliche statement, but it's so important. But then I would also say like the quest and the curiosity to continue learning is massive. Like I said, if you think you're done in this game learning, then I think it's, you know, you're kind of dead, and you can never stand still in football. It's constantly evolving.
Real awesome. Yeah, I guess last question to kind of tie everything up. What would, you know, what are you most excited about when looking ahead?
Ooh, look, excited about when looking ahead. I think just the ability to, for me, just the ability to see where the game's going to go in the next 3 to 5 years. I think we're seeing a lot more investment now, especially in the UK and the US. I think there's other countries that have caught up to the US, if you like. And so, you know, there's opportunities. There's playing opportunities now in Portugal. There's playing opportunities in Spain, Iceland, Sweden, UK, US. Now underneath, well, I guess not underneath, but in the MLS, they have the USL, which is underneath. In the women's side, they're going to have the USL that's going to try and compete with the NWSL. And so, again, there's going to be a place for people to, like, for more females to play. And I think that's what's really unique is, you know, if players don't potentially find an NWSL team, they can then go play for a USL team. Or if they can't find a USL team, they could then play in the NWSL. So I think what's going to be really unique is just to see how far we come in the next 3 to 5 years with the investment and the sponsorship and broadcasting deals that we're seeing.
Brilliant. And I think that with that alone, they become other opportunities, whether it be coaching to help supply and demand those particular professional teams and leagues, but I guess also just broaden it away from just coaching around the other off-pitch roles, whether it be kit managers or marketing, finance. So, yeah, exciting Definitely. Times ahead.
Definitely.
But, thanks very much for your time, Sarah. Some real golden nuggets in there that I think those listening will definitely take away with them.
Thanks for your time, Lloyd. It was great to chat. It's nice to hear a familiar accent.
I bet. Yeah.
Hello, mine's a bit dodgy. Yeah, now.
Yeah, it's something that you take for granted, isn't it, before you move out in the States. And then, when you hear the accent again, it's a bit, takes you back home, doesn't it?
Exactly. I appreciate your time.
Great. All right. Thanks a lot.
Cheers.